Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Diplomats Podcast on Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Kak from Washington.
Today we'll be talking about a series of issues related to naval developments around the Asia-Pacific region primarily, mostly focusing on military hardware and a few developments diplomatically. First, we'll talk about the Western Pacific Naval Symposium, which happened in Qingdao, China recently, where naval chiefs from across the region agreed upon a code for unplanned encounters at sea, which is an important document that should prevent some miscalculations from occurring. At that same symposium, a brief 15-minute meeting took place between two senior Chinese and Japanese naval commanders, and we'll discuss the significance of that meeting as well. Following which, we'll talk about Japan's recent deployment of 100 ground self-defense forces to Yonaguni Island, which is Japan's westernmost island, pretty close to China's coast, which has been regarded by China as somewhat of a provocative move. Following which, we'll talk about Taiwan's plan to build its own diesel-electric submarines, and then if we have time left over, we'll talk about Australia's decision to purchase F-35 aircrafts. So let's start off by talking about the Western Pacific Naval Symposium. So this took place in Qingdao, China, as I said, and the biggest outcome of this was a document that's known as the Code for Unplanned Encounters at Sea, which has been in the works for a while. The symposium takes place every 2 years, and at the last symposium, which was held in Malaysia, China opposed the Code for Unplanned Encounters because it opposed to it being called a code, which implied sort of legal force, and it's not really that sort of document. All it does is it just sets up, the way I understand it, it sets up common codes of conduct and communication between navies in the region. As our listeners will likely know, the South China Sea in particular is the site of a massive proliferation in boats and naval hardware, so it's very important that these navies are able to prevent miscalculations by communicating with each other in a clear way. So what the code essentially does is it sets out a set of clear protocols for these navies to employ if they find themselves facing a boat that appears to have unclear intentions. Particularly the methods that they use for communication include colored flares, which is, you set up one colored flare if you're indicating that you're about to retreat or pull back, or if you'd like to ask for passage through an area. And apart from that, they have a list of sort of English language terms. And I also believe they have sort of procedures for pointing out and dealing with situations like divers in the region, fishing boats, and other things like that. So, Zach, what do you think? Do you think this code will be successful at sort of preventing miscalculations in the region? Do you think it's a good development?
Yeah, it's definitely a positive development. I mean, I think it's mainly just like codifying different words or whatever, different language, so they're all speaking the same terms. But so, I think most importantly, it shows this continued desire that we talked about in the last podcasts of China and other nations in the region to kind of de-escalate. At the end of, there's a lot of more and more close encounters as the navies grow in the region. We saw this a lot last year, especially in the East China Sea and sort of in the South China Sea, where there was, which create potential for miscalculation. So this kind of reduces the risk of this miscalculation, which seems to be a common goal at this time shared by all the navies. All the countries, they seem to be very focused on trying to de-escalate situations, but same time, it only really applies for miscalculation. So, like, one of the big things that happened in the South China Sea recently was the Chinese destroyer cutting off the U.S. ship in the South China Sea, and that, like, this code wouldn't stop that because that was a deliberate move on China's part. So, I mean, that's important to note that, like, it's not going to stop necessarily escalation.
Yeah, you're referring to the USS Cowpens incident, right?
Yeah, the Cowpens.
That was intentional. That was intentional on both sides, really. I mean, the U.S. ship was monitoring the Liaoning and its and the frigates and destroyers with it, and China responded in kind. So yeah, I agree. Definitely wouldn't prevent that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the U.S. was monitoring, but it was monitoring from like the appropriate distance as far as like naval code goes.
Yeah,
and China just still didn't want that to happen, so it tried to cut it off and try to. This wasn't wasn't trying to create a miscalculation. It was trying to,
Yeah, whatever. I mean, so what I'm interested in is, how China would respond in the future if there actually is a miscalculation and another party, let's say an ASEAN state, for example, alleges that China didn't comply with the code for unplanned encounters. I mean, it seems like if that comes to pass in China, simply says that the code has no real value or doesn't really apply, it seems like it'll be a big setback. And, I see a real possibility of that happening.
Yeah, and it's important to note, I think you mentioned how this China imposed this at the last Western Pacific Naval Symposium, but I mean, one of the reasons, it's not that China caved on this, as far as I understand, it's that they made it completely non-binding, voluntary. They made that explicit, more explicit than last time, so China like got what it wanted, basically. Everyone caved to China, kind of. So I mean, it might be interesting. It might be like a tool to demonstrate, because China's going to try to say like miscalculation, maybe, if China's the provoker, and this will make it less easy for it to pretend like it had not, you know, that it had just miscalculated and hadn't done this intentionally. So that might be interesting, but I mean, it's not going to tie them down, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the meeting that occurred on the sidelines, which, you know, some people have been regarding as a huge development. Other people are more skeptical. Is that Admiral Wu Shengli of China and Admiral Kawano of Japan briefly spoke for 15 minutes. It's a rare example of two high-level officials from these two countries speaking. Zach, what's your take on this? Are you a skeptic or are you optimistic?
Well, I'm skeptic because they were supposed to, or at least Japan had said before that they were supposed to have like a formal meeting, which I saw as significant. And then, you know, the last minute China started saying there wasn't going to be a meeting and denied that there ever was a scheduled meeting. But it seems like, you know, my take is that China basically pulled out of the meeting last minute to kind of like embarrass Japan. And I think it was kind of in protest. Some MPs, I think, visited the war shrine. And someone close to Prime Minister Abe had visited the war shrine, so I think like they pulled out in response to that. So I mean, I think like it's interesting, sort of, that they spent a few minutes talking, but really it was it sort of showed China's continuing willingness to like let the dispute roll on and not really take huge steps to solve it, or not like meet officially with Chinese officials or Japanese. China's decision not to meet with Japanese officials until, you know, Abe does certain things. So I think it was not really significant at all. I think it was showed more like how low relationships are still.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was on the same level as, you know, Abe and Xi Jinping briefly shaking hands at the APEC summit last year, which people talked about a lot as well. I mean, it's interesting that, like, you know, you talk about China's bargaining position right now with Japan. It really can't interact officially with Japan in any significant way at the risk of looking weak. I mean, last week's podcast, we talked a bit about the Track 2 initiatives that are going on, a bit of city-to-city diplomacy, and that seems to be it right now until, you know, either Abe leaves office and another less nationalist Japanese prime minister comes into the office, or Abe apologizes, which I think is very unlikely. So I don't think we're likely to see any changes on this.
Well, China can control the demands. I mean, like, what, you know, we've talked about this before. I think you said that, I'm not exactly sure what China's demanding Abe do, but I think whatever it is, it's like vague, like apologize for Japanese militarism or something, or visiting the war shrine. But I mean, if China can control like what it's demanding, so I mean, it might look weak, but like it can kind of like finesse this. This is what diplomacy is all about. Like, say, like, you know, all of a sudden say, you know, pull back from those demands, or like state exactly what Abe could do. And maybe Abe can, you know, if Abe knows like he's going to get a meeting with Xi Jinping, if he does like, you know, some sort of small action, then China can kind of save face while moving the relationship forward. But I just think my personal view is that China does not want this to happen. It wants to continue hyping the Japanese, supposed Japanese threat, and return to militarism because it distracts from, you know, its own many consider assertive behavior in the region.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, it distracts, but also in a sense highlights it. I mean, the more China talks about the dispute with Japan, you know, the more it points out its own position in those disputes, which is read by other countries in the region as being assertive and destabilizing. But we'll see. I mean, speaking of assertive and destabilizing, Japan recently decided to deploy 100 ground self-defense force troops and set up a radar on Yonaguni Island, which is its westernmost island, kind of equivalent to its Key West, you know, just 100 miles, less than 100 miles off China's coast, which has been regarded as sort of a provocative move by some in China. I think it sort of plays into that you know, dynamic of border disputes with China in general, well, border and territorial disputes in general, where China tends to respond. Well, you tend to have more luck with China if you play a forward position. I think if you talk to policymakers in India, they tell you that as well with its own dispute. So I think Japan has kind of taken up its decision to be more assertive. Like we talked about in last week's podcast as well, you know, Zach, like the new research that M. Taylor Fravel and Alistair Johnson showed, that the more Japan kind of plays its forward position, the more China sees a possibility for escalation, the more it kind of shifts away from physical escalations to a war of words. And I think that Japan is kind of playing that to its advantage right now with Yanaguni. I mean, what do you think about the radar deployment?
I think it's just going to be part of a continuing trend that Japan's like basically set in its military, its defense and national security strategy documents, basically, that's going to be gradually over the course of the next coming year strengthening its ability to its surveillance and intervention capabilities around the islands. One of the things that's interesting about it is that it's probably, it looks to me like the radar could be used to monitor cross-strait, or at least either activities in Taiwan or in the Taiwan Strait. So I think that's also factoring in Japan's calculations. And then on the escalation point, I mean, actually would point reader or listeners to there's an article written by Eli Ratner and Bridge Colby at Center for New American Security. I think it was on foreign policy. Might have been War on the Rocks, though. And they were talking about trying to take actions. They wanted the U.S. to do this, that made China less confident they could control escalations. And that's kind of what Japan was doing with, like, saying he's going to shoot down the drones and stuff. And it did work. So it's an interesting strategy for maybe the U.S. to try as well in the South China Sea and East China Sea.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll see how that kind of plays out in the region.
But I would say also, before we move on, it seems like, what was this response from China to these new cessation of troops? It didn't, or the radar, the new radar, like, it didn't seem to me, I didn't see any like huge responses from China.
No, it wasn't a huge response. I believe they made a few statements about, you know, warning Japan to not destabilize things and not push the territorial dispute. I mean, also, you know, we have had comments from China about potentially pushing the first island chain and the Ryukyus, which is huge for Japan, and that's, you know, Japan sees that as incontrovertibly its sovereign territory. So I think I think you're right that, you know, they didn't make a huge deal out of it, but there was still a negative response from China.
But I think this goes, there's a negative response, but it's pretty muted. But I think this also, we were talking just, you know, in the last segment kind of about how, like, Japan, we were saying that China doesn't want to really highlight its ongoing dispute with China, or China doesn't want to highlight its ongoing dispute with Japan because it could worry, like, South China Sea nations. But I think this kind of evidence, like, it makes it look a lot more big deal of, like, you know, the visiting the shrine and, like, certain other things that are just Japan. It's not even necessarily the Senaku dispute. It's, like, it highlights, like, Japan's, like, you know, collective self-defense and stuff rather than the Senaku dispute for that very reason, is it wants to get Southeast Asian countries concerned about Japan, not China and Japan's dispute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, let's, I guess, move on to the next part of the podcast. I believe, Zach, do you want to tell us a bit about Taiwan's plans for indigenously building diesel electric subs?
Yeah, so during a parliament hearing, was it last week, I think? Taiwan's Minister of Defense announced that the country was going to move ahead with plans to build 8 diesel-electric submarines, and as many of our listeners will probably recall, the U.S. originally said it was going to sell Taiwan these 8 diesel-electric submarines back in 2001, I believe, but the U.S. doesn't make diesel-electric submarines anymore, so it's been kind of like, you know, this whole agreement has just been kind of falling apart. Nothing's really happened, at least. So this is like finally Taiwan taking a step, saying it needs these diesel-electric submarines, so it's going to build it itself with U.S. assistance. However, as James Holmes has noted on the Naval Diplomat, since the U.S. doesn't build diesel-electric submarines and hasn't since the 50s, you know, it's kind of questionable how much assistance U.S. can really give Taiwan. And it's also, Holmes notes, it's kind of late in the game for Taiwan to be doing this because, you know, it's going to take years to develop the capability to build these submarines and actually build them, and then they're going to have to learn how to use them. So, I mean, somewhat late in the game, but I think overall, in my view, and you can jump in too, is my view it's going to help, if it does work, it certainly help Taiwan's defense posture towards China.
Yeah, I think that's a given, given that China isn't, you know, too experienced or good at anti-submarine warfare and things like that. But, the point I made earlier in our conversation was that, China is essentially going to be able to outpace Taiwan in sort of any technological race. I mean, you know, Taiwan obviously isn't building these in order to take on China one-on-one. I mean, the intention always for Taiwan is to count on support from the United States and Japan. And I think, you know, the point there is essentially that Taiwan needs to have its own capacities to kind of hold off an initial invasion by the Chinese, cause unacceptable losses to China in the initial phases of any assault across the strait, allowing the United States and possibly other allies in the region to kind of help Taiwan maintain its borders.
Yeah, exactly. I think with China's the real goal of Taiwan in recent years is, I think, has been to like build up these take advantage of asymmetrical advantages it can have. It can't meet China boat to ship to ship, like plane to plane.
Right.
And so I think it's really trying to find these key niche areas where it can kind of exploit Chinese weaknesses. And one of these areas is anti-submarine warfare. And we should note that other nations have noticed this. I mean, Japan's also, it already has a decent submarine fleet, and I think it's recently announced plans to build on that substantially. This is like Taiwan's, this is another example of Taiwan exploiting asymmetrical advantages it could have over China for the purpose of, like you said, just kind of delaying, hopefully deterring, but at least delaying and Chinese invasion to the U.S. and I'd say Japan, and probably possibly others can intervene. The other interesting part of this, I think, is it highlights maybe what might be a new kind of strategy of to build up Taiwan's defense industry with U.S. urging and possible assistance, so that the U.S. doesn't have to sell Taiwan weapons, because that's obviously a lot more provocative for China. So I think it's trying to get Taiwan to be able to build some of the stuff it needs itself so that it doesn't actually have to sell it to them.
Yeah, that'll be huge. I mean, also, like, just from a military opportunity cost point of view, I mean, I'm reading J. Michael Cole's report for us about Taiwan's decision to not pursue the Oliver Hazard Perry class frigates. I mean, that would be, I think Cole writes, a 157th of Taiwan's entire annual defense budget, which is a pretty significant cost for, you know, four boats that would likely be sunk almost immediately in the initial phases of any Chinese assault on Taiwan. I mean, by contrast, you look at these submarines, I think investing in that longer term definitely provides Taiwan a better return on investment in these asymmetrical capabilities.
I think the ships, if I remember correctly, were like 157, like they were like more than Taiwan's acquisition budget, not necessarily its whole defense budget. I could be wrong though. It was just what was weird about that whole development is like Taiwan had asked for those ships and said it wanted like at least four of them, and then the U.S. approved it during like the Sunflower Movement or whatever. Congress decided it was going to approve these. It was for the 35th anniversary of the Taiwan Relations Act. It approved this like these sales, and then right when it did so, Taiwan's like, actually, we don't really want these ships anymore. And I think if I remember correctly, this was kind of what happened with these submarines, is that once Bush said it was going to sell them the submarines, at first, like, Taiwan couldn't finance the deal. There was like, the DPP, I think, was trying to undermine the sale, or the KMT was trying to undermine. It was for political purposes, but basically the opposition party wouldn't agree to the deal to sell these submarines, or to finance the deal so they could pay for the submarines once they got the U.S. to accept them. So this is kind of like a trend now with Taiwan, is it asks for stuff, and when the U.S. agrees to it, it says, actually, never mind.
Yeah, a little bit of fickleness. Yeah, I just checked. That's actually a 157th of the entire annual defense budget, which makes it
really
even a worse deal. Yeah, I mean,
Taiwan's
go ahead.
I was gonna say Taiwan's also, its personnel costs are going up. It's raising a lot of like the benefits and the pay to troops as it switches to a volunteer force. So that's gonna be eating into its acquisition budget too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking of expensive purchases and bad deals, Australia decided to purchase 58 F-35s at the cost of $12.8 billion, which is like the largest defense deal in Australian history. And I think that has some interesting implications for the F-35 program across the board. You know, I mean, partly it sort of reaffirms people's belief in the notion of the F-35 being a worthwhile investment, as, you know, doubts have risen across the board as the program's prices have shot through the roof. And I think it shows that Australia is going to essentially be, you know, pretty much ardently in the U.S. camp going forward. Zach, what's your take on the F-35 purchase here?
Yeah, I think it's good. I mean, you know, it was sort of inevitable. If they're going to purchase, like, you know, the 17 original ones, whatever it was, you know, they weren't going to give up after that. There was some concern though, because they bought those 10 Super Hornets last year, but that was just a stopgap measure. So I think it's probably a wise choice. I think it definitely helps the F-35 program. Now we're going to have South Korea, Japan, Australia and the U.S., all U.S. Marines and the U.S. Navy or Air Force operating them. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to have, I mean, my people I've talked to that are kind of close to it say that Singapore is all but have signed on. So, and the big point about this is that they have these combat cloud capabilities where they perfectly integrated the information of each individual aircraft can be sent to all the other F-35s in the area, regardless of nation, and they also can be sent to different missile systems. So, like, one of the ways that they'll could use these is, like, say South Korea, for instance, could fly them over North Korea, their stealth, and then, not that it really matters with North Korea, but could fly over North Korea and identify targets that its missile systems could then send that information to the missile systems, and the missile systems could take out these targets, even if the targets were mobile or whatever, because it can kind of be used in that way. So I think it's going to be, I think people, the doubters of the F-35s, I think kind of over, I mean, it's definitely an expensive thing, but I think it's going to be a huge boost to U.S. and allied air power in the region.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. All right, I think that's all we have for this week, and stay tuned. We'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.